28th. Interviewers are Eleanor Bloom and Ann Fagan with Mr. Lenny Littman. Take three, side one. Okay, Mr. Littman, we're going to start today by picking up on something that you mentioned earlier that we didn't really talk about. You talked about Saul Yurok and your connection with him and the Bolshoi. Would you like to tell us about that?
Well, I met Saul Yurok in New York. He invited me, along with other concert managers, to show him what he had for the season. And we talked for a while about what we were doing, and he asked me if I could take on the Bolshoi Ballet. And I said, sure. I said, what's the deal? He said, well, he says, where can you put it? I told him that the Heinz Hall, or the Penn, see, we were running the Penn at the time.
What was the date approximately? Can you recall?
It was about 67. 68, and he said that he wanted a professional promoter to handle it because it was expensive, and I said, sure, I'll take it. I don't know about the billing. I told him about Syrian Mosque. He said that wasn't deep enough. I told him about the Penn, which was then being run. That's the place where we put in Ella Dolly. So I told him about the Civic Arena, and he said that his son-in-law, George Pepper, would be in to see me. And I said, well, what's the deal? And he says, well, can we get $75,000? I says, you mean dollars? He said, yeah, I said, I think so. And they came in, and they finally decided to take the Civic Arena in the same setup that Civic Light Opera was. And even after that, see, you can't fly scenery at Civic Light Opera. You have to bring everything in from the sides. And that was one objection. But then he got a better offer in the Sonic in Detroit, and he was going to back away. And I told him that couldn't, because we had a contract. And then I was asked by any number of local groups who wanted to sponsor it, and we decided on a group that entertained visiting people from Pittsburgh. This is Ann Patton. Anyway, it was Pittsburgh visitor. And it was very successful. They came in and they had all the big, the whole ballet was here. It was sold out. It got wonderful reviews. And it had 15,000 people in two nights. And
was that the first appearance of the Bolshoi in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I think it's the only appearance. Mm-hmm. See, they always played, and they came before in Cleveland at Public Hall. There wasn't a building big enough. You don't have a building in Pittsburgh big enough yet. It's so deep. They needed so much space. Now, maybe this new Benetton would be able to do it. But we worked together on a couple of other things. But the Bolshoi never came back.
Let's talk about other work that you did for a number of years, and that was your nightlife column for the press.
Well, Leo Koberlein was the editor of the press, and he was on he was the managing editor of the Pitt News when I came up there to help promote the 150th anniversary of Camp Richmond. And I stood around and I wrote a column or two for the Pitt News, but I had very little to do with it. But we became friends then, and during the years, whenever I would have a nightclub or a show, I would usually see him to get publicity, to okay in my advertising. I remember I brought him in an ad one time, and I said, will this run? And he says, well, if you're going to ask me, you know I won't. So one day he said, he asked me a few questions about a show business, what was that? Licensing and show business for ASCAP. And see, I used to see him maybe once every 2 weeks when I had a show or I had a night company. And so he asked me one day, he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I have Harry Belafonte coming into Heinz Hall, and I'm working country. I have a few, Bob Dylan in Albuquerque, and a few shows around the country. He said, why don't you write one of those columns the way you do in Variety? I said, okay. I said, but you know, I can only do so much. He said, well, he said, you always wanted to be a newspaper man, didn't you? I said, yeah, but I've never been able to afford it. Now I can afford it, I'm willing to do it. So we decided on a weekly nightclub column. And it started in 1970, and was headed Lenny, then it was headed Nightlife, and went for 15 years. It's at the beginning, in the beginning it was once a week, twice a week, but when they switched to the Weekender, they wanted me to do two columns, one during the week and then on the weekend, but I thought it was too much because there wasn't that much nightlife in Pittsburgh then. Nightlife was diminishing. And I stayed there until 74, except during the two strikes. And the strikes were on when I went on the radio and did a talk show.
How did that go?
Very well. I interviewed Woody Valley, Sally Rand, all the stars that came in from out of town, like Nixon people, like Dennis Day, Al Martino, Marty Allen, all the celebrities in the show business were out here that I interviewed.
This was on WJA?
WJA.
And how often did what was the length of time that you did that?
I used to go from 12 to 4 every night while we were on strike. Then when the strike was over, I just went back. Then we struck again about 6 or 7 months later. But then NBC bought the station.
Did you like radio work?
I like radio. It's not like anything. It's enjoyable while it lasted. And, I kissed it goodbye when it was over. Just like when the call was over and my life was over. We said goodbye. My clubs are over. Yeah, you have it all over Pittsburgh, you see, where there's no more vaudeville, there's no more stage shows, no more nightclubs.
What do you see for the future of Pittsburgh and show business? What do you think's going to happen?
Well, I see where video cassettes have kind of dominate. Because it's cheap, it's so available, and the product is so good, and there's no cost, there's no labor cost, and I see no future for live talent. With Benedum and Heinz Hall competing for the few road shows, we'll see good road shows, but they'll all be big musicals. The straight play will be over, except the Pittsburgh Playhouse and some of these very good legitimate groups we have in the city. And the movies will be with us. They'll be here because people like to get out. And as for the nightclubs, there will be another way of presenting talent in the nightclub because the people like to go to nightclubs because they get away, a place for anniversaries, weddings, celebrations, and to meet people. This is a constant problem in our society, meeting someone. You can't meet them if you're sitting in your living room watching a movie or watching television. There will be a new phase in my life, and you will find it in the cities and in the suburbs, that there will be a different method of presenting the shows that will attract the people to come in. And largely because of the constant costs, like they're going up, like with insurance, it's gone up 400%. Talent is very, very high. A few people that are good enough to bring in people charge so much because they are in demand in the cities like Atlantic City and Las Vegas, where the gambling casinos pay their fee, and places like we have here in Pittsburgh, like the Holiday House, the Marriott, there's four or five places that have talent, but they can't afford the bigger ones because the bigger ones have an established price and insist on that money before they come in. But there is, the nightclub will live, but under a completely different umbrella. It's the thing that we have, the Carousel, the Copa, and the Monte Carlo, the New Arena, are all downtown. We have five or six right in the heart of Pittsburgh. That's over. Yeah.
Would you encourage young actors and actresses, entertainers, to go into nightclub work there?
An actor or an entertainer, anybody of talent, should find a showcase or a stage to present his talent. Now, if he's, we were talking about a Jackie Heller. A Jackie Heller started entertaining on the sidewalks of the city with his ukulele when he was selling papers. As he grew up, the big attraction for people going out was ballrooms. So he went with a big band like Ben Burney, and he traveled all over the country with big bands. There's no longer big bands. People keep saying, when are the big bands coming back? They don't come back. Nothing comes back. They revive things, but they don't come back. But if Heller showed his talent as a singer, as a master of ceremonies, she did it to Harris, and then he did it, he was an entrepreneur, and he opened nightclubs, and he had places like the Carousel, the Showboat, and the Yacht Club. And with his talent, he was able to do anything in show business. Now, for instance, right now, if you're a good singer, girl or boy singer. And during the 50s and the 60s, you had one record and overnight you became a star. Today, a singing single cannot even get a record. In those days when people like Rosemary Clooney, Patti Page, everybody just had one record, they became a star. And they're still stars today, they're still getting good money. But the ones that for instance, the ones that played the Copa, who it was one record, overnight became a star, became accepted, and today are still established and making their $20,000 a night, for like Johnny Mathis, Tony Bennett, Frankie Lane, or even Nat King Cole. He started with his record, and when he got to a point, he played the nightclubs. And there were nightclubs all over the country. And they were able to go in the nightclub. Now, there is nobody making a record single and becoming a star overnight, unless there were the big groups, the big band, you know, Bruce Springsteen, you know, the Noel Diamond. You have nothing, there is no gateway to stardom as there was in the days of the 50s and 60s when the person sang a song. Somebody made a record, the disc jockeys played the record, and there were nightclubs to show that they had the talent and establish a following. Now they go from one record, they're groups, it's usually groups. They go from one record, one big smash record, they go from playing scale and some third quarter time to a big arena. And they're making $50,000-$60,000 a night. We don't have that here. In Pittsburgh we have places like the Decade or the Graffiti who have little groups, they show them. People look at them, but they don't get the exposure they once did. And the future does not say where the venue will be as much as the talent will show itself. But then the fact that there's no opportunities will hold the talent back and they may not get the opportunity, but some way they'll find a way to make it.
Here's a chance for you to be the grand philosopher for it. As you think back over this wonderfully full and varied career you've had, what are the things you're proudest of?
Tell you the truth, finding my wife.
Nice answer.
It's a stabilizing factor. See, I waited until I was 32 to find the right wife. I wanted a wife. I didn't want a sweetheart. I didn't want a date. I wanted a wife. I wanted someone my whole future. Someone who liked what I was doing. And she was a helpmate all through my life. That is a very important factor. That's, you take a career and you have somebody backing you all the way and standing on the sideline and helping you and letting you know that. That is a very, very important thing in anything you do. Because, you know, there's a lot of flops. We went to camping one time to do a show and nothing. Can you imagine coming back 90 miles after losing $9,000 on a show you thought would sell out? Or like the Charles Lawton incident. He was a big star. We had him for two shows, the Syrian Lox, and he played to 1,500 people. And most of them were school teachers from Lenore or school teachers from Brady. We sent them tickets. We knew they'd appreciate it because he was reading from Dickens and various authors, and then you go home and you're with a wife who understands the win or lose and the cultural benefits, at least you have, because you can't win them all. And then the other thing was to read the trade papers and go to different cities and see what the attractions are. In the nightclub business, the best thing that the successful nightclub owners did was use the telephone. I would get up, when I got up, see, agents never go to work until about 12 o'clock. And that was about the time I got up, and I would call all the agents. And I would say, you sign anybody new today? And they say, I don't know, I'll see. And then they look and they sit and they say, like a Johnny James, even a Johnny Mathis was a very good example. This is Johnny Mathis. It just so happened that I had reviewed him when I was writing for Billboard. That's another trade paper. And I thought he was very good. And I said, well, what does he want? And he said, well, we don't know. We can't sell him anywhere. Do you want him? I said, yeah, I want him. But if the price is right, then I get the right options. He says, wait a minute. I think we're dropping him. So he said, yeah, we're dropping him. I said, who's got him? He said, Associated. So I talked to the woman over at Associated, and she says, yeah, we took them on. And we have a review here from Spike Wallace from the Sun Photograph. Do you know him? It seems I'm Spike Wallace. Yeah, I was writing reviews for the paper by Quincy and my name. And I said, yeah, I like his opinion. He says, well, what do you want to give us for him? I said, well, let's try them at 200 and give me five options. We'll raise them $200 every option. He says, you got a deal. And so Johnny Mathis came in, and it's five times. And the last time was the time that he brought in so many people that there were crowds all around Liberty Avenue on both sides of it, and they lined up for blocks, and in fact I was arrested for that. But then there was people like Johnny Ray, somebody tipped you off. So I went to, he is a piano player. I went to see him, and he was the worst piano player I ever heard. But he sang, from May to December, the September song. He did that 15 minutes. He did about 20 choruses. Horrible. So then about, just must have been 3 or 4 weeks later, when I was calling news agents, that we got somebody, Johnny Ray, who has a record called Pride, and this is the angle. And the writer of the song is from Utah, Churchill Palmer. And he said, "Did you listen to the record?" I said, "No, I haven't listened. Have you listened to it?" He said, "Well," I said, "so who is he?" He says, "Well, we think it's a girl." So this conversation on, I says, "Well, if he said, the songwriter's from Pittsburgh, I'll take a shot." And it was the same thing, 205 Austin. And so he came in, and he was very, very, the record had taken off by that time, and he kept going. And one of the things while he was in the club, this was the second visit, Perry Como came in and wanted to hear him. And he saw Perry Como in the audience, he broke down and cried and ran off the stage. But as like Christine Jorgensen, I was woke up and Beth was reading a New York paper, and I saw when this operation was successful. So I cabled her, and I offered her $500. And she wrote her book, just like a real actor. She said that he offered me $5,000. You know, I told you I never paid anybody more than $3,000 at Nat King Cole. In fact, to get back from there, my brother Archie ran into Frank Sinatra's agent in Philadelphia, and the agent says, "I can get Frank for you for $3,500. You want him?" He says, "No." He says, "Lay, that's my Jewish name." He said, "Lay won't go over $3,000. And so we didn't get Frank's stuff. But that was a period when he was very much down in his dump. And he was, but getting back to the Christine Jorgensen thing, I got a call about 7 months later from an agent and said, "You're still interested in Christine Jorgensen?" I said, "Well, what can she do?" "I don't know. She's taking lessons. She has a straight man. She's dancing." I said, "Well, for $500, how can I go wrong?" I said, "Give me a couple options." They gave me 2 options, and this was a very, very successful engagement. And during that period, there was one record distributor. His name was George Barber, Barton, whatever it was. Okay, we were playing record names all the time. He was a record distributor. He lived in this whole world. Records. And so that week we had somebody with a big record. I think it was Andre Philippe, who had just come off Chance of a Lifetime. And he said, "Well, who do you have next week?" I said, "Christine Jorgensen." He said, "What's her record?"
You've talked a lot about Jackie Heller as someone who certainly impressed you in your lifetime. Are there other people who stand out in your mind as being really important in your life, besides your wife?
Well, my brother. He was...
Archie.
Yeah. Everywhere he went, he found some act, and he signed him. One time, he sent me in the 5 Gypsies. He found them in Baltimore after a racetrack. And he would listen to the radio here and there, and he would tell me about it. Or like Joni James, she used to hang around the Copeland, just hang around as a customer. In fact, she was in a talent show there and she lost. And when she became hot, he says he heard about Joni James. He says she's right there, why don't you sign her? I said, "She's become very big now, she needs money." And he says, "Give it to her." He would, as I say, he would listen to the radio and the records, and he made, he was their friend. He was the one that, like in the Steve Lawrence situation, this is where the, see, the Jewish thing came in twice. See, Steve Lawrence had a record. It was a $200 act for the record. And he says, I'd like to take off on Thursday. And I said, why? He says, well, I got to sing Kol Nidre.
You told us. Yeah. That was a good story about
Steve. Yes. Whenever I...
The people who had influenced you in your life, and you had mentioned, of course, Jackie Keller, and your wife, and you talked about your brother Archie.
Jackie didn't influence me. I mean, he made me keep, aware that I had serious competition.
Mm.
But he played, see, he was a singer, and I played nothing but singers, his headliners. And since he was a singer, he could only play comedians. He played comedians like Jackie Gleason, Alan King, Jan Murray, Victor Borga. That was his type. But we battled for space in the papers. I would always say my Tony Bennett or Johnny Ray or Johnny Mathis or somebody like that is more important. We were always fighting for the little bit of space that we could get.
Yes.
In those days, there was no nightclub columnist. The only one we had was Harold Cohen. And then Leonard Mendelwitz started a nightclub column in the Sun Telegraph. That was the first one that we even got a picture in the paper. Now, Leonard was very, very good. And he helped the nightclub industry more than anybody because he started this column and it grew and grew and was very, very popular. Then there was a column by Carl Krug, and then there was a column in the press by the Rounder. But we were having very, very difficult to get your name in the paper.
Was so Harold Cohen
helpful? Harold Cohen was the most helpful of them all.
Hmm.
The, one line in his column meant you could sell out for the week. He was very influential because everybody who went to nightclubs read Harold Cohen's column. And this, as it would follow, if he saw somebody was good, like he liked, he said when he said Pearl Bailey was coming in, when Pearl Bailey came in, then she would sell out. So many, he had such good taste, and he brought his wife with him on occasion, Stephanie. And Stephanie didn't always tell me who was around on Broadway. So she was an actress. And she was a straight man for a guy you want to buy, Dr. Joe Penner. And he was very, very helpful. And naturally, whenever he liked something and he mentioned it, we got it. But see, nightclubs was on the lowest part of the show business entertainment pages. We used to get a two-column reader, a two-paragraph reader, was all we could get. But, then we competed, Heller and I competed, but see, Heller was an entertainer, and he would go to do all charities, and but he didn't like television. So he wouldn't let his people go on television. But since I was an entertainer and I had no qualms about it, I knew the television was here. I was supplying the talent for the television shows that were on WDTV. And I was doing shows right at the beginning in television. So I had shows like June Christie, Tony Bennett, Alan Drake, Beachcombers, Mills Brothers. I would take the acts that I was playing and put them on the television show. But Jackie Heller refused because he felt that television, he was right in his prophecy, was going to ruin nightclubs. And actually, at the time the television came to Pittsburgh, it was the time that he saw the drop. And he saw that there was no one like on Tuesday, you never could, you forget about it, that Milton Berle was that powerful. And since he, in answer to your question, he was a competitor that actually added to my capacity because I was showing three times a night and he would go, or he had a dinner show and a midnight show. So my 10:30 show was always packed, usually from half of it from his people. And when they went downtown, there were places to go to. There was a choice, like I said. They had the Carousel, the Copa, the Monte Carlo, the Midway, the Carnival, the Hollywood Show Bar, and the New Arena. They all were there, and they all were gone by the time 1960.
Anybody else who comes to your mind as being really important in your life, either in or out of show business?
You take Caspar Monahan. Caspar Monahan was the first legitimate drama critic who started putting nightclub items into his column. And he would take a liking to somebody, he would help them. And then he became a constant customer. And there was Henry Ward, who then finally followed me, started writing a column. And they would come down and see every one of the newspaper men, every one of the disc jockeys, were on what we call the full scholarship. That no matter what they wanted, what their check was, I always picked it up. So in this way, this was a round robin. Then the agent,